Welcome to the podcast service of the Massachusetts Climate Action Network. Visit us online at massclimateaction.net or friend us on Facebook.
Hi, and welcome to the Climate Minute, your source for insight and perspective on global warming news. My name is Ted McIntyre, and this show is for the week of December 17th, 2017. Today we're joined by our frequent guest, the prolific commentator, Mr. D.R. Tucker. How are you doing, D.R.?
Doing well. How are you doing?
Very well, very well. And we are joined by commentator and author, Ms. Mariah Tinger. How are you doing, Mariah?
I'm well. How are you?
Good. You like that Johnny Carson kind of thing? Here's Mariah. Here's D.R. I've been working on that. All right. So let's see. There's so much to talk about this week. One of the interesting things that has transpired in the great city of Boston has been an effort, which is actually fairly advanced at this point, to try, or not to try, but to ban those plastic bags that you see dangling from branches and clogging up the sewer drains all the time in the city of Boston. So the supermarket shopping bags are at risk of being forever, I don't know if we can call this podcast, banned in Boston, right? Bags banned in Boston. But there is an effort there, right? I mean, did either of you guys hear anything about that? Or what's I mean, it's not been very well covered, but what's the state of play that we know of?
So on November 29th, the bag ban was passed unanimously by Boston City Council. And I guess now that it's now sitting on Mayor Marty Walsh's desk. Mm-hmm. And, you know, he's got some concern. He sort of said that maybe it's unfair to senior citizens economically. Is it, you know, charges a 5-cent fine for every paper bag they use? And he said we're nickel and diming our senior citizens. So it bans single-use plastic bags outright and then charges a 5-cent fine for paper bags or the thicker sort of reusable plastic ones.
But in favor of trying to encourage people to bring their own bag to the store.
Yeah, exactly. And I listened to this, I think it was an WGBH report where the opposition, I forget who the guy was, but he was saying that, you know, the bag ban will hurt local retailers and that people will order online to avoid a plastic bag fee, which I'm sorry, but that kind of seems absurd to me that, you know, a 5-cent fee is going to drive people to order something on, you know, from online and pay shipping and handling. I mean, that just, I don't know. But I think if people are driving, I don't think that the 5-cent fee for single-use plastic bags is going to drive people to order online. I think there's other things that are driving them that way.
I heard interesting commentary saying from somebody, I think it might have even been the same report, saying that in certain parts of Boston, people have to take mass transit to and from the supermarket, and that bag. So I guess you can give away bags without handles, but the bags, like the shopping bags you get at the supermarket with little handles, are prohibited. Right, and how that is a burden on people that have to carry lots of bags back and forth to their homes, which I don't know. Maybe that's there are a lot of people in a lot of circumstances, but I mean, I think if the goal is to encourage a habit of carrying one of these now ubiquitous cloth bags, right? I mean, remember to bring those to the supermarket. You're generally speaking going to be okay, right? I mean, it's I think that the bag ban, banning the bags is a good thing. Did you hear anything about it, DR?
Mariah had mentioned the coverage on WGBH. And there was also some great coverage in the Globe as well, and also coverage in MassLive.com, I think it's the Springfield Republican website, in which one of the representatives from the Big Bag, I guess one of their lobbyists is basically trying to say that it somehow runs afoul of the Massachusetts Constitution, that somehow attacks on the poor. It reminds me of some of the scaremongering regarding the bottle bill from a couple of years ago in Massachusetts, or the scaremongering about you know, trying to ban you know the selling of eggs from chickens that were raised in cages. Right. It's like this sort of gloom and doom, and the problem is, you know, with this all this sort of gloom and doom rhetoric, is that if you've ever been to Brookline, Brookline, Massachusetts, I believe a few years ago, passed one of these bans, and you know, life goes on. No one is saying that they're unfairly burdened. So I don't see how this argument can logically stand.
Yeah, I heard someone. Go ahead.
Well, I mean, I don't have all the details, but I do know. So, Maura Healey, you know, Attorney General Maura Healey, who I have great respect for, she did object to something like this. I don't have all the details. Did you guys hear anything about that?
No, I have not. I mean, I've been abysmally ignorant of these goings on. I mean, I think that if you're going to ban these bags, you want to do it fairly in a way that doesn't impact people in any negative way. But it does seem like there are a lot of mechanisms to get rid of these bags and not put people on the spot in ways that they can't manage, right? It just and the greater good seems to be to get rid of the bags. And what I heard is, I think it was Emily Norton. I think she was Norton, the Sierra Club. Yep. I mean, she, you know, basically that this is a you know, Boston should be leading by example. It's the biggest city in the Commonwealth, right? And other cities will follow suit if Boston goes down that route. So there you go.
Yeah. And so I did find it. It was the Massachusetts Attorney General's office disapproved of a similar ordinance in 2015 in Williamstown.
Oh, okay.
Sort of on the grounds of what you were mentioning before, DR, that it's, you know, it's unconstitutional to retail establishments.
Oh,
so it's an interesting sort of,
you know, free speech thing where you can't, you know, my free speech to give you a plastic bag. I'm gonna put your wedding cake in this plastic bag.
and again, to reiterate, the Brookline ban was implemented in 2013, and again, the sky did not fall.
All right. Well, if you go to Boston, remember to bring your shopping bag, because you may not be able to. You're going to be carrying your milk and eggs back in your hands. All right,
yeah.
Well,
it sounds like Walsh has Monday, December 18th to decide. So if he doesn't decide one way or the other, it's just going to go into effect.
Okay. All right. Well, so the second thing is also kind of a legal issue, right? And talks about laws and stuff. But it's I don't know if it's much bigger. It's certainly different and consequential, entirely different kind of scope of things. Many of you may remember that there is a legal doctrine that goes back centuries, that is called the public trust, that the government operates in the public trust. And it essentially is a legal document that says the government has a responsibility to hold the air and the water and the shipping channels and sort of the natural environment of the country in trust for everyone. And traditionally, that sort of trust has been worked out in terms of making sure that the planet or the country is economically viable, right? So the public trust doctrine kind of brings you the Corps of Engineers that maintains the Mississippi River, right? So the government takes responsibility for dredging the Mississippi River so that the whole economy of the country can flow back and forth, right? But you can also interpret that public trust doctrine as a responsibility to preserve things like a livable climate, right? That public trust doctrine is being exercised now, is being used in a legal case. So let me put the ball in your court. Tell me what is, and I'll just put the word out there, this Giuliana case, named after the last name of one of the youthful people bringing the court case, right? Tell me what has happened in this case recently.
Yes, the Kelsey Giuliana is the lead plaintiff in the case, and several days ago, the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals held a hearing to determine whether to allow this lawsuit to proceed. So, for a bit of background, the U.S. District Court Judge Ann Aiken, who sits in Oregon, basically ruled that the case could go forward. The 21 plaintiffs suing. Originally, they filed the lawsuit against the Obama administration, the defendants after the 2016 election was changed to the Trump administration, arguing that that in essence that the Trump administration is acting in an unconstitutional manner by refusing to take action to reduce greenhouse gas emissions and thus therefore subjecting these plaintiffs to essentially disparate treatment relative to what they would receive if, you know, their right to a stable climate was recognized.
And when you say disparate treatment, these people, now they're basically high school students when they started out. Mm-hmm. They're young kids, and they're saying mm-hmm. that their future happiness is being unfairly stomped on by the federal government because the federal government's not addressing the climate issue, right? That's kind of the crux of the case. Yeah.
Exactly. So Judge Aiken allowed the case to go forward and initially scheduled hearings for February the 5th. However, the Trump administration went to the U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals for the Ninth Circuit to file, I believe, what's called a writ of mandamus. I may be mispronouncing that. Essentially, what the Trump administration is trying to do, they're trying to have the case thrown out on the grounds that the plaintiffs have no standing to sue, that they cannot prove that the Trump administration's inaction on climate will damage them, and also they're claiming that there is no such thing as a constitutional right to a stable climate, and that therefore atmospheric trust and therefore public trust does not apply with regard to cases of greenhouse gases. The Assistant U.S. Attorney Eric Grant has alleged that if the plaintiffs are allowed to go forward with this case, it will basically allow a feeding frenzy of lawsuits over people claiming damage by federal government inaction. Now, I should disclose, because people are going to point this out, that I have expressed skepticism about whether the mm-hmm. plaintiffs will succeed, because I remain deeply skeptical about, at the end of the day, whether judges will run afoul of the sheer power of the fossil fuel industry and its allies by ruling that citizens have a right to a stable climate. But nevertheless, it should be noted that a majority of the three-judge panel seem to be skeptical about the prospect of throwing this case out, and they seemed inclined, according to numerous reports, to allow this case to proceed on the district court level. So we shall see how they all
play. So just to understand, the case was brought at the district court level, which is, as mm-hmm. the name suggests, is sort of a lower court level, and there the mm-hmm. judge was sympathetic to the plaintiffs, the kids who are bringing this court case, right? Mm-hmm. The judge, and if the judge is sympathetic, the reason that's important is because if that were the case, then the high school kids as the plaintiffs could bring in high-powered climate scientists to testify about the issue and get that information on record. Right, that's what
exactly.
The stakes
and in fact,
are.
And in fact, Jim Hansen has already agreed to testify on their behalf. That's my understanding.
So at the district level, the judge is smiling, and the feds, mm-hmm. The Keebler elf attorney general, Mr. Sessions, has decided to leapfrog over the district court and go to the appeals court, right? Which mm-hmm. is the there's only 9 districts in the country of appeals courts. This is a much higher level court. He's going to mm-hmm. them to say, oh, that jerk down in the district court doesn't know what she's talking about. You need to throw this whole case out because these kids don't have a real lawsuit. They don't have, mm-hmm. I think you said standing, which is kind of this legal phrase about whether or not you have the right to bring a lawsuit, right? So mm-hmm. that's really what's happening. Not really what's happening, but that's what's happening is the feds are trying to go to a higher court to squash the lower court.
Mm-hmm. That's exactly. The Trump administration is also claiming that it will be an extraordinary burden to try to prepare for the case. In other words, by implication,
who knew climate could be so complicated, right?
By implication, what they're trying to say is that trying to find, and in fact, there have been some, the Trump administration in preparation for a disfavorable decision, they've been trying to find the usual coterie of quote-unquote skeptics in the scientific community to sort of back their case up, but that's obviously a fairly difficult thing to do. So essentially what the Trump administration is trying to do is they're trying to figure out some way to stop this case cold, which I think is very, very interesting because, again, as I've said before, I think that the sheer fear of the power of the fossil fuel industry and right-wing media would be enough to ultimately get a ruling against the plaintiffs.
But the Trump administration, I guess,
would not take any chances.
The implication I've heard is that this Ninth Circuit court is not a slam dunk for the feds, right? This Ninth Circuit mm-hmm. might, in fact, send it back to the district court to actually have it all heard, right?
Exactly. And I think the interesting sidebar to this is that one of the judges who was on this panel, the three-judge panel hearing the case, is apparently under investigation for inappropriate conduct. Apparently he – let's just say there are allegations that he is prompted a bit of a Me Too movement among some of the people he has worked with. Yeah. So it will be interesting if he's removed as a judge and if they'll have to rehear this case again with an all new panel and see how that goes.
Well, we like to follow the these sort of legal, arcane legal things, so we'll keep an eye on that. But you just – I mean, we hadn't mentioned this before, but you talked about the federal government finding a bunch of House scientists to – plead that climate change isn't real. Did you see the article that said that Scott Pruitt and his red team, blue team thing, they're queuing that up for sometime in January, where they're going to have the great climate debate between the red team and blue team scientists over whether or not climate change is real? I mean, that is a debacle waiting to happen. I don't know where to go with that one. All right, so look, there's Giuliana. We are keeping an eye on the Giuliana court case. It is a an important one. I guess the there's so much to talk about. I was going to say, so Mariah, you had mentioned something about there was some new, so a couple weeks ago we talked about the wildfires out in California, which are still burning brightly, right? The Thomas Fire is now more than 200,000 acres. I guess like the third or fourth biggest fire in California history. All climate related due to the boom and bust cycles of water out there. But tell me, what's the new sort of fact that that people ought to have when they hear about this wildfire stuff?
Right. Well, so you may have already said this, but the in past episodes, but there hasn't been any major wildfire that has ravaged California in December since they started keeping records in 1932. So this, you know, to have this kind of a wildfire raging is very unprecedented. This is the season for mudslides and flooding in California. On Wednesday, there was a new collection of papers that was published in the Bulletin of the American Meteorological Society, where scientists around the world analyzed 27 extreme weather events from 2016, from just that year, and found that human-caused climate change was a significant driver in 21 of those.
Wow.
And, you know, that's a big deal for scientists to sort of say this kind of stuff emphatically, because, you know, there's always a measure of uncertainty in science, right? You can't, I mean, these are models. They're using predictive models to say what's going to happen due to climate change. Mm-hmm. They've been able, the climate attribution science has gotten significantly better since the original Bulletin of American Meteorological Society started in 2011. And they have been able to say with increasing certainty that climate change is causing these extremes. And, you know, some of the extremes they've said are definitely caused by climate change are the record temperatures around in 2016 are the record temperatures around the world, the massive coral bleaching on the Great Barrier Reef, the drought in Africa, wildfires in North America, and the I guess there's a warm blob in the Pacific Ocean. That's, I don't know if that's the scientific term for it, but that's
more good news.
Algal blooms. Yeah, really? Exactly. So you know they have these things that they're definitely saying this is. You know, sure, El Nino might and La Nina might be a part of it, but there's no question that anthropogenic climate change is causing these, mm-hmm. and we need to do something about it.
Interesting. Yeah, I mean, the confidence to be able to say that a large number of these extreme events have roots in climate change is, I agree, it's an impressive thing to be able to say. So I guess the other interesting thing that is out there is that a couple of weeks ago we talked about, of course, we love electric vehicles on this show, right? And Tesla, the famous Tesla automobile company, electric car company, had announced that they were going to offer what is essentially the cab or the forward part of an 18-wheeler kind of truck setup where that engine for the truck was an electric vehicle that could go 500 miles. And that was pretty cool thing. So I guess, Mariah, tell me, what has transpired since our Elon Musk announced that he was going to start selling 500-mile electric 18-wheel trucks?
You know, I love these Tesla questions. So he, let's see, I think, when was it? On December 7th, Anheuser-Busch put in an order, a pre-order for 40 of these Tesla semi-trucks, which was the biggest order that Tesla had gotten for these trucks to date. And then just on December 12th, PepsiCo put in an order for 100 of these semi-trucks. So that puts, that gives Tesla, I think, they have, let's see, I think it's 270 now orders in for their wow, electric trucks. And they won't be producing them until 2019. But along with these, you know, so this is all very cool for Tesla. I'm excited for it. You know, this is, you know, the trucks have a 500-mile range and they're fully electric powered and they have autonomous driving capabilities. But along with these sort of orders, like Anheuser-Busch, for example, said that they're constantly seeking new ways to make their supply chain more sustainable, efficient, and innovative. And they're also talking about how, you know, these trucks will help improve their road safety and lower their environmental impact. And then PepsiCo says the trucks are a key part of its plan to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. So seeing these companies, you know, say out loud that we're buying these trucks because we want to lower our greenhouse gas emissions, I think is a really, that's a good big headline to have, right?
That's great. That's great. That's great.
So I want, and we should also add, in addition to Anheuser-Busch and Pepsi, CNBC has reported that Walmart has also pre-ordered 15 of these trucks, and apparently the shipping company DHL, according to the Wall Street Journal, they're also interested in investing too. It will be very, very interesting to see if UPS and FedEx also invest in these sorts of trucks. We know that so long as Mr. Trump is in office, the U.S. Postal Service probably won't, but we'll see what happens in the 2020s.
Well, so here's my question, my closing question. Which quarter of the Super Bowl ads will contain the Anheuser-Busch ad showing the Tesla truck pulling the Anheuser-Busch beer across country? Is it going to be the first quarter? Is it going to be the halftime ad? Is it going to be in the third quarter?
Pulling some. It'll have some horses on the back of the.
It's going to have the Clydesdale. It'll be a contest between the Clydesdales pulling one way and the electric truck pulling the other way. See. All right. Well, that is great news. I love the idea of an electric. I'm going to keep my eyes open. So what we'll do is we'll put up some links to what we talked about on the blog. It's at massclimateaction.org/blog. You can find us also on Facebook at /massclimateaction. And, of course, you can listen to us directly on your smartphone using Stitcher, TuneIn Radio, Overcast, Podbean, SoundCloud, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. You can, of course, find us on iTunes by searching for Massachusetts Climate Action. So we'll close the way we always close, by saying that because we recognize the necessity of personal accountability for our actions, because we accept responsibility for building a durable future, because we believe it's our patriotic duty as citizens to speak out, we must insist that the reckless policies of the new administration not be accepted as normal, and that the United States put a long-term and equitable price on carbon. So thanks for being here, DR.
Thanks.
Mariah, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you.
Thanks to everyone for listening. We will be back again next week. Take care. Bye-bye. Keep an eye out for those Tesla semis. Bye-bye.
Thanks for being with us. And until next time, be green.
Very cool.